Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, it's Liz joining you as usual from Central Virginia and the unceded lands of the Monacan Nation. And I'm so glad that you are here with me today. And hey, as always, if you would like to know whose lands you might be residing on, please be sure to check out native-land.ca. It's got an excellent map, especially helpful, I think, for North America, but other parts of the world too. And I will put that in the show notes. And if you're interested in learning about the sacred feminine, there's a whole bunch of ways you can do that, but I'll tell you a few that I offer. So you can check out my award-winning book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine, and that's available wherever you buy your books. You can check out the classes available via the Home to Her Academy. I'll put that in the show notes. And then you can follow me on social, at Home to Her on Facebook and Instagram, and I'm actually on TikTok now, kind of exciting. You can follow me there too. And you can also check out past articles and all the past podcast episodes at hometoher.com. So all of that will go in the show notes. I will ask you if you're a regular listener and you haven't done so already, I would love for you to leave a review of the show wherever you access it. It really helps other people find it. We've creeped on up there now in the top 2% globally of podcasts, which I think is kind of awesome. Every time you review it or pass it on to somebody else, that really helps. So if you feel inspired, that would be amazing. Same thing with the book. If you've read the book and you liked it, I would love it if you would leave it a review on Amazon or Goodreads. And then as always, I love it when you reach out to me. So please feel free to reach out via social for your thoughts, your comments, your feedback, your suggestions. I'm here for all of it. And with that, let's get on with the show. So my guest today has been on my wish list of potential podcast guests for a long time. I don't know if she knows that. And I'm so happy that we're finally making it happen. And I was just telling her right before we got on, and she probably, I don't think she knew this, but I started my Home to Her Facebook group. I basically just invited all my friends when I did it about 5 or 6 years ago. Anybody that I thought would tolerate me and talking about the sacred feminine. And I got really excited every time somebody new joined the group that didn't actually know me. And my guest actually joined. She was one of the earlier guests. And I remember looking up her profile and her information and feeling super excited and validated because she's been on this goddess path for so long and has done such amazing and inspiring work. So with that, I would love to introduce her to you. Annie Finch is a poet and performer, an artist who brings poetry into magical collaborations with music and theater, a scholar and researcher on meter, magic, and matriarchy, a teacher, an inspirational speaker, a ritualist, and an activist. We could just spend the whole episode unpacking that sentence. So good. In short, she is a poetry witch. Annie is the award-winning author of 7 books of poetry, including Spells, New and Selected Poems, Eve, Calendars, a verse play on abortion, Among the Goddesses, and The Poetry Witch, Little Book of Spells. She is also the author or editor of numerous influential books about the magic of poetic craft, as well as editor of Choice Words, the first major anthology on abortion. Uniting all of Annie's work is her belief in the power of languages of the goddess to awaken magical change in words and the world. Annie traces her lineage from Norse, Volures, Celtic bards, and witches imprisoned in the Salem witch trials. She travels widely from her home in New York to lecture and perform and has shared her poems and inspirational teachings in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mexico, and across North America, Europe, and India. Her teaching is also available on YouTube, on her Substack, and in Poetry Witch community. And she's actually joining us today from a women's run retreat called Sacha in Guatemala. So Annie, it's such an honor to have you here. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Liz. I'm really, really happy to be here. It's a wonderful space already to be in virtually, language-wise, your voice, the whole energy, the history, the herstory of all the podcasts you've done before. I'm just delighted to be here in your space.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I would love to start As I always do with spiritual background, I'm a curious person. I love to hear how people got to where they are, from their early influences. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear a little bit about that from you.
Wow, yeah, that's a big question, isn't it? Because we're
It
at a
is.
period of transition for everyone, and so many of us are, creating from in one way or another, creating something new out of what we were given. So it's a transformational question you've asked, isn't it? I would say that I was lucky in that my family background was very spiritually aware and conscious. My father was a philosophy professor who had a huge interest in world religion. So he had all kinds of books about world religion around the house. He was interested in Confucianism and Taoism and Hinduism and all kinds of things. And my mother was a very witchy woman who didn't realize it when I was young, but she was always, I think. So I had, a lot going for me. I also had a ton to overcome because in all of those 40,000 books my father had, there was nothing that I am aware of about the divine feminine, the goddess, anything really. A couple of like saint, women saints, maybe in Christianity, who had like hated their bodies and destroyed themselves physically, that kind of weird, twisted attempt that feels like to access their goddessness. So it was hard. But when I was 6 years old, I had this incredible experience where my father had a sabbatical, and we spent over a year traveling around on a pilgrimage around Europe and the Middle East. So I got to see there were many, many approaches to spirituality. We visited a lot of cathedrals, but and things like that. But we also visited Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids and the temple to Aphrodite in Greece. We went to Eleusis, where the Eleusinian mysteries were. So there was an awareness that there were other options, other paths. So I think that kind of opened me up. And then, yeah, well, I guess I can leave it there. And the other thing I just want to say is poetry. I think that poetry was my initial opening to the goddess. I was lucky that both of my parents loved poetry. They actually met at a lecture about poetry by the poet Auden. And so people were always reciting poetry aloud and sharing their poems that they loved in my house when I was growing up. So I got a sense of the rhythm of poetry, which has turned out to be my most powerful path into the goddess. So that was a great gift as well. So, it hasn't been easy, but I did have a lot of gifts at the beginning that helped me to survive it and to transform.
Yeah. And can you tell me about when or how, if there was a specific moment that you became aware of, I say the sacred feminine, divine feminine goddess, you choose your language, whatever works for you. But was there a specific moment or moments that where she really came forward for you?
Yeah, there were moments. I'm actually writing a memoir right now called Incantation, and putting together that memoir, which I've been trying to build the structure of for like 15 years, all these false starts, but it's forced me to really think about those moments and the moments that helped me to survive. And I'll just tell you three of them. The first that I remember was when I was 5 years old, and I was standing with my mother and my grandmother, and we were standing outside at night for some reason, and we were looking at the full moon. And it was a rare moment for me because my mother had five kids. My father was like a big overgrown kid, so she didn't have much time just for me. And her mother lived up in Maine. We were in New York, so her mother wasn't there that often either. So for me to be with the two of them alone was a very precious and rare moment. And I remember them both looking up at the sky, pointing at the full moon, and saying, "Look, the moon, look, the moon." And that was such a powerful moment for me because I suddenly felt, I think it's my earliest memory, and I suddenly felt just like I was part of something and they were part of it too. And I realized now that was the goddess, my mother, her mother, the moon. And it just gave me a sense of, that it was okay, that things were going to be okay, that they were okay, that I belonged, that my heart was part of a lineage that had the goddess in it. It was an incredible moment. And then the second moment, when I was 12 or 13, I think maybe just 13, also involved the moon. I had been molested. My uncle molested me sexually when I was in seventh grade, when I was 12, and it really brutalized me. And I began to cry all the time. Nobody talked about it in my family. There was no awareness. I mentioned it to my mother, and she just said, "Don't talk about it," you know. So it was very traumatic for me. I started crying a lot. But I remember this one moment, and it must have been my second or third time I had my period right around then. And I was standing on a porch alone, and I had my period. I was looking up at the moon, again at the full moon. And I just remember also feeling, you know, where I am now is not my real home. My parents, the people who don't get it, that's not my real home. That's not my real tribe. There is something more for me, and it's powerful. And I'm gonna get through this, and I'm gonna blossom. I'm gonna become a person who knows how to be grateful for this beauty, for the power of this moon above me. So that was another moment that was really powerful. And then I guess the time it really came to me in the form where I knew it was the goddess was when I was 34 and I had had my first baby. I had just finished my PhD. I had worked myself to the bone. I had a home birth very early, 1990. There was not a lot of support. And my midwife quit in the middle of the pregnancy. It was like terribly traumatic time. And I'd stopped sleeping because nobody told me to take my pre-meds, my prenatal medications, vitamins. So I didn't have enough calcium and I stopped sleeping. I didn't have proper health care because the midwives were not legalized and there were hardly anybody around. It was hard to find anybody. So it was very difficult. And I stopped sleeping and I had a break. I had like a postpartum break. And coming out of that was when I really found the goddess for sure and realized that I had to transform my entire life because they put me in the emergency psychiatric ward. They were strapping me down on the gurney. I was screaming and fighting. I didn't know what was going on. It was just horrendous. And then when I got out of there, I was there for a few days, and then they tried to give me these medications, which were horrible for me. The medications, because I was breastfeeding, they couldn't give me lithium. They gave me something even worse that was like made me all fuzzy and dead inside. And they were treating me like some kind of, you know, incompetent person. I just couldn't stand it. So I said to my husband, "I'm not doing this. I can't do this again." And he starts crying. He was scared. And I just said, "I'm going to heal myself." So I was in San Francisco, and because of luckily, I had support at that time because of what I'd been through to find my healing path. And I started just going all out. And I discovered whole new ways of being that were not specifically, you know, marked as goddess. They were like alternative shamanic healing was another really important one for me. But they all were goddessy, but I didn't realize it yet because I didn't have a framework of goddess or matriarchy or anything. And then this one moment that it became the goddess for me consciously was when I was in the mission in San Francisco, and I was having it was an acupuncture massage center, a wonderful place. And I walked out after my treatment into this courtyard, and they had this gigantic statue of Kuan Yin that was magnificent. It was surrounded by wildflowers, just so many wildflowers. The sun was on it. The bees were buzzing everywhere. The butterflies. It was just this super rich, full goddess energy, like matrix that was just right there, just so funky and sensual and, you know, complete in every way, the way the goddess is, death and life and everything, just there, body and spirit. And I was so blown away. And I just stood there looking at it for just being there with her for the longest time. And I just was like, oh, this is it. It was like I trained myself to her smell at that moment so that I would always find it again. And I just knew that if I held on to this and I kept it strong and I kept it, you know, center of mind and tried to ignore all the patriarchal bullshit around it, that it would grow and get bigger and that I could be part of it and that it would encompass. And there were so many other people, obviously, that were aware of it as well. So it was this really wonderful moment. And around the same time, I met my first witch in San Francisco in 1990, Francesca de Grandis, and started going to her rituals and discovered that there was a whole community of witches who were aware of it as well. And then I also discovered the power of poetic meter. I revisited that again and realized how that was also a goddess thing all along.
Oh, I have so much to just, I want to like un, I started to say unpack, not the right word, but let's just pull the threads. But one thing that I just want to riff on for a second that I was thinking about as you're saying this is, and I've heard this from other guests as well, and it's very true in my life that this experience of what I call the sacred feminine is so experiential and embodied, and it's not in dogma. It can't be. And so I just was having a moment of thinking about, outside of conspiracy theory, right? Because we can get really reductive, I think, about like, well, how did we get here? But seriously, like, who thought it was a good idea to put all this shit down in sacred books, you know? Because like, as soon as you do it, it sort of like
Messes up
loses
everything.
the numinousness of it or the life of it. I don't know. I just was, yeah.
I have a theory.
It hit me with your theory.
Okay. So yeah, this is going to be in a book that I'm working on long term called Witchosophy. And this is a book where a lot of it is based on the theories of Heidi Guttner Abendroth, who's a magnificent scholar of matriarchal societies. She's in Germany. Her work has just been translated into English in the last few years, and a lot of people don't know about it yet. But her first huge book was just translated, Matriarchal Societies, which is like a survey of matriarchies around the world. And now her next book has just come out. I'm going to be reviewing it for a fantastic feminist magazine called Liber, pretty soon. Liber, great magazine, recommend. So anyway, yeah. So Heidi, from working with Heidi and through Association for the Study of Women and Mythology, which is an organization I'm on the board of now that I love so much, I learned a lot about matriarchy. And Heidi's definition of matriarchy involves worship of the divine feminine is one of the key factors that defines a matriarchy. So her work has been really helpful for me in thinking about how did we get into this mess. But then from it, I've come up with my own kind of poetic wackiness. So here's my theory. My theory is that women invented religion, period. Like, I actually think it came out of orgasm. I really do. Women's orgasm. And this is why, like, flowers are still considered romantic, and all the Valentine's Day stuff is like the goddess stuff, right? So I think women invented the whole thing, and it's what we naturally do and what we naturally love. And I also think that women don't use rules. Like, I've spent entire weekends with 20 women, 25 women, organizing and magnificent rituals and amazing experiences together without a single rule. Ridiculous. We don't need them. But I honestly feel, and I love men very much. I've been married to one for 40 years, almost 39 years. I think men like rules. They really do. They like to codify things. And I think that, so my theory is that there must have come a time, maybe. I also think that men want to help. These are my two things about men. I think men like rules and they want to help women. And that matriarchy is based on this, that women are kind of doing the culture, moving the culture forward over the centuries, and men in a matriarchy help. They help, they serve. And in whatever way. And sometimes that means being a chief or taking leadership of some kind, but the women always have kind of the final say, right? So I think that there must have come a time when, probably because patriarchy, so certain patriarchy is about certain men controlling other men, right? And exploiting other men, killing other men. Patriarchy is really about men and men, And I think they just want to get women out of the way because it interferes with men's loyalty to other men and men's ability to exploit other men. If the men's loyalties are towards their women, then they can't be exploited by other men, right? So I think what really happened is some of these patriarchal men came in, and I love the books by Mary Mackie. She's got these great novels about old Europe and how old Europe was invaded by these people from the area of Central Asia with their horses and the bronze and the metal, and they just basically they took over the matriarchal cultures of old Europe that Maria Gimbutas, the great archaeologist, was always talking about and proved. And now her theories have been proven to be true by genetics and other things. Anyway, so the patriarchal men came in, and these matriarchal societies didn't know what to do. So I think what happened probably was that the men had to take over the religion that women used to deal with, the God, divine feminine goddess religion. And in order to help out, men were like, okay, well, we'll hold on to this. We'll take it over for now because, things are in chaos and maybe the men were helping or something, but they had to codify it and write it down because they didn't have the instinctual, whatever. I don't want, that sounds like a condescending word, but they didn't have the women's wisdom and the wisdom and the women's ability to spontaneously recreate the goddess in every moment the way we do. So the men had to like write rules and and look at that, like they wear dresses and they do all these weird things that seem to somehow mimic women's ways. So this is my sense of it, that the rules and all the rigidity and all the stupidity of writing it all down was definitely men who did it, but I don't think men did it with bad intent. I think they were just trying to keep it alive until women could come back and pick up where we left off.
Oh my gosh, I love this so much. For a couple reasons. I'm so glad that it just seems very reductive to me and honestly still in the binary of patriarchy to go with, well, men suck and they just want to hold women down. It's like, no. If everything is an expression of the goddess, then that doesn't work. That's just way too simplistic for me. And
Well,
it keeps us in a
helpful moving forward. Sorry. Yeah, I didn't mean to
yeah.
interrupt you.
No, and it keeps us in like a villain victim mindset. Like there's nothing helpful about that to me. And to your point, it's not even accurate, I think, to what I see reflected back from at least some of the men in my life. It doesn't make sense,
Right. Totally.
So
Totally.
I love that. And then the other thing that I was thinking about as you're saying that, I have been reading, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, but I got interested in classical tantra and reading a little bit about classical tantra. I'm not talking about Western tantra, which is all, sex focused, which, hey, all well and good, but more of like the older texts, like what is this about and how does this compare to some of my study of yoga? And what I've really been struck, I read a book called Tantra Illuminated by a man named Christopher Wallace. I'll put that in the show notes along with everything that Annie's mentioning too. But what I was really struck by in reading it, I really did appreciate this book, is that it gave me a framework of understanding some experiences that I've had in my life. And in the absence of the community and the structure to hold me around the divine feminine, which to your point, I kind of just had to get on this path on my own. She had to come find me. And then over many years, I brought the people into my life that can support me and we can explore it together. But that those texts, ironically, and I see what you're saying. It's almost like I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, this is a man trying to understand what I already know in my body and explain it to someone else. But then the irony of that is it's helpful for me to have the man to now say it back to me because I have not had the community and the grandmothers to pass down the wisdom generation after generation. So it's like, oh, yeah, no, this was a real thing that's happened in my body. And there are people that have been trying to understand this for thousands of years, and they wrote it down in a way so that it could be accessible to other people. And I really did have the moment many times of reading it. I was like, they just needed to ask the women, like, what was going on? That's all they needed to do.
I know. That's so often the truth, isn't it? It's like they're doing their very best, but they just needed to ask the women.
Yes.
It reminds me of a moment that I had one time when I was with my son and we were at this retreat thing, and the guy, and I saw this older man. He's some professor, but he was doing this kind of new way holistic ceremony thing, like a shamanic retreat, I guess it was. And but I saw him saying to my son, well, the thing about women is they're able to, like, they just really have this very complicated system of understanding how things work, and they're like, and they're taking into account this and this and this and this and this. And I was listening to him describe it in male terms, and I was just laughing because no woman would ever bother to do anything that, I don't, I mean, I think women are brilliant, don't get me wrong, but it's like, if for me, if it wasn't, intuitive and organic and spontaneous and involving my heart and my soul, my body and my will and my mind all together, I wouldn't. But he was describing it like it was mind. He was describing it from the outside, like what women do is all a matter of calculating a million different complicated mental things, these little pieces, instead of like a whole flow of being part of the goddess. So It was like from the outside, but it was interesting to hear him describe it. I'm not sure if that's exactly akin to what you're describing, but
Yeah, well, that, yeah, that, yes,
that's
exactly.
great.
Yes. And I think in a culture like we have now, where, I mean, you've clearly found the goddess path and have been on it for a while now, and I've found it too. We sort of are still at this place. I mean, she's much more prominent, I think, visible culturally than
Yeah.
perhaps, I mean, you can speak to that, but I've certainly any other time in my life. But like in the absence of sort of like a real respect for her, like broad-based respect for that wisdom and her in general, I actually think the spiritual teachings can be really helpful, but only in as much as we could look at it and go, I already knew that. I knew that because I felt it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, someone here in Guatemala just gave me or lent me a copy the other day of the Celestine Prophecy, which I had not read before. And it starts off with synchronicity and everything, which is of course a wonderful way the goddess shows up. But it's very interesting. I think it was published in about 10 or 15 years ago, and it's so far I'm just a third through it, but it's a good read, and it has a lot of spiritual insights. And it's funny because the total absence of the divine feminine is just such a glaring lack. Like, it would make it so much simpler, but it just wasn't in the vocabulary then. But you can see that, it's all sure, okay, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I know that book too. I think I tried to read it after I had my own kind of awakening moment, and I was sort of reaching for anything. This was about 10 years ago, and like what would align. And I think I read it, and I think because it didn't have the divine feminine, I was like, I'm not interested in you. I want to
Yeah.
find things that are talking specifically to what happened to me. I know what you're
Exactly.
talking about, but I wonder, that actually brings up a question for me, because you've now been on this goddess path for some time, and I wonder if you have reflections on how you think things are shifting and changing. You know, if you kind of move up to like sort of a macro level, and she's this flow of water, like where she's carrying us, where you see us
Yeah.
going.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. I think it's easier to talk about her directly than it used to be. I mean, it feels like it used to be pretty fringy and taken more literally in the community of goddess people. I really wish I'd been on it longer though. Like, I wish I was 20 or 30 years older and had been able to be part of it in the 70s in like California and stuff, because there obviously was so much going on. And a lot of that stuff is not preserved. And a lot of those women are, of that generation, like, 10 or 20 years older than I am, like Judy Grant or B.B. Fraser, for example, is somebody who, I don't know, they just had so much wisdom. Like, B.B. Fraser, someone I met, she's a midwife and she knows a ton of songs, like all these goddess songs, tons of them. And she just has them all, but she's of an age where they're not like recorded, they're not online, she's not really techie that way. And this kind of wisdom could, and I know quite a few women like this, Matcha Nightmare. She's wonderful, wonderful. I can put you in touch with these people if you want. But I mean, they haven't, because of the technology's changed so much, and because I think women spent so long not really having the bandwidth with women of older generations, a lot of that wisdom feels like it could get lost. And so I just want to nod back to all those incredible women in the 70s. So when I came along, it was already kind of diminished in that sense in the 90s, and it felt like it was more marginal. Like, the women's building in San Francisco, it used to be such a hub of activity in the 70s, had kind of much quieter, like, it was just, it seemed like things were kind of shut down a bit in the 80s and 90s. And then, so it was more marginal and literal, like, in the sense that people would literally get into these goddesses. Mayumi Oda, the amazing artist, was someone who really helped me a lot when I was in the Bay Area. She does these magnificent, iconic goddess art, so beautiful. But they were like incarnated specifically in these goddesses. And then I think nowadays it's tricky because of the much greater literacy and awareness of cultural appropriation. And it's not, it used to be more like, oh, great, the more goddesses, the better from all cultures, because there's such a multiplicity of them. And like Patricia Monahan, who's one of my great mentors in this whole goddess thing. She did the Encyclopedia of Goddesses and Heroines. She started the Association for the Study of Women in Mythology. Like, without her, I wouldn't be where I am at all. And I think so many other women would say the same. Patricia Monahan has been unbelievably important, I think, in this whole movement. But, you know, she, like, the way I understood it from her, it was more like all of these goddesses, so thousands and thousands of them around the world, are all manifestations of, you know, of the divine feminine, like different faces. And yet it's, I think, been a little harder in the last 10 years or so, or 15 years, to talk about it that way, because different cultures are wanting to claim their path to the goddess. And for women who have Northern European ancestry, a lot of that is really lost, right?
Yeah.
We've had patriarchy so long and so hard and so deep, compared to other cultures that might have a very more recent, difficult, horrendously awful trauma, but there might still be a stronger matriarchal roots behind that that they can return to. But I think for me, even when I think about, I edited a little book called An Exaltation of Goddesses, where I found some poets to write poems about goddesses around the world. And when I did my own, I wanted to find a Northern European goddess. And I looked back, and the furthest I could get was Freya and Frigg, who are clearly two different aspects, the good one and the bad one. Like, Frigg was the dirty, racy one, and Freya was like the domestic good one, like the virgin whore dichotomy.
Yeah.
And clearly they both came from one goddess originally, before that, before she got split in half. So my goddess ended up having an asterisk in front of her name, because we don't even know that she existed. She's hypothetical. She's
Yeah.
a you know, what's the word they use in linguistics for a word that they posit existed as an ancestor to two words, but they don't actually know it, so they put an asterisk in front of it. I forget the actual linguistic term, but I put a little asterisk in front of her name, Frija, Frija, which there's no actual evidence of her, but we can assume she was there as the common ancestor of the virgin and the whore, Freya and Frigg. So I feel like, you know, there's been more emphasis on to finding your own goddess from your own ancestry, which is beautiful and wonderful, and I'm very grateful to have it. It's been very powerful for me. I also feel that another result of the more awareness that people are getting of their own individual lineages is more willingness to talk about the divine feminine in general now, not so much specifically like, you know, let's get into Isis, Astarte, Diana, Hecate, Demeter, Kali, Inanna, which is this beautiful chant from the 70s, which I love so much, with those specific goddess names, but more being able to talk about the divine feminine or the goddess. And I really like that, because I think it's accessible to a lot of people, and it's maybe less frightening to talk about it now. Like, it used to feel like if you talk about the goddess, people would think, oh, it's like God, you know, oh, she's going to like tell us what to do, and they'd be all freaked out. But to be able to now, like, I've just been here in ceremony with a group that had some men in it, and they were, you know, when I was talking about matriarchy, they were like, oh, does that mean men are all bad? I'm like, no. So, like, we were in this mixed group, but we were singing songs or hearing songs about goddesses and the divine feminine. And I began to get a sense that, yeah, this new generation coming up, like, there is a space to talk about the divine feminine in a way that people would maybe begin to understand, that it's inclusive, it's make space to, the men have a space, everybody has a space in it, and it's not like the female counterpart of the vengeful, scary patriarchal god telling people what to do. It's not hierarchical, it's not rigid, it's not rule bound. It's a very different creature, even though it's a spiritual reality. So I guess I'm feeling optimistic that we're maybe coming back after, you know, that height in the 70s, when it was more just for women, just marginal, and more about specific goddesses, gathering as many goddesses as we could find information about, and then almost a bit of a lull, and then it's gradually surging back now, the last 10, maybe 15 years, surging back into a more general awareness that the divine feminine is safe, it's okay, and that we all have our own paths to it, but that we can also love and appreciate and make space for the paths of any human on earth, because we all have our own connections with the goddess. Yeah.
Yeah.
historically as well as personally.
For sure. I think the other thing that I'm thinking about as you're saying that is for me, the intertwining of the sacred feminine with animacy. And so that, I don't know how you feel about that. I'd love to hear your reflection on that. But when I mean, I have European roots as well. And so, kind of thinking of like, okay, going back to a tradition that predates Christianity in my ancestral line on soil that my ancestors once lived on, but they lived there 400 years ago, like and farther back, like how do I find her? What I have found is that in some ways it's actually easier, and the energetic frequency is the same if I go sit in the freaking trees and like connect deeply with the land. Like there she is. That's
Yeah, very much so. And I think so many people that, yeah, I remember talking to someone from New Zealand, an indigenous woman from New Zealand, and she was just saying, for us, it's just nature, it's just the trees, it's the ocean. They don't even necessarily put it into goddess form, and yet I feel that it's imminent in that, in the same way that the goddess is imminent in nature, when I think that's for me the biggest difference in thinking about the theology with an O versus theology with an A, is that the God is transcendent of the world and goddess is immanent in the world. In the same way, it feels as if for you can find her imminent. If she's really imminent in the world, you can just find her anywhere in the world, right? Which makes it again so much easier to talk about, totally. And then look at Maria Gimbutas, right? Her amazing books, The Language of the Goddess, incredible books with all these beautiful photographs of these ancient goddess artifacts and art from all over old Europe. And it's all, so much of it is animals. And also beautiful abstract patterns that show energy movement. But all these animals were sacred to the goddess, like so many, owls and octopuses and doves and frogs. Oh my gosh, her stuff on frogs is amazing. Like spiders, I mean, everywhere you look, right? There's always stuff. And yeah, it's also amazing, the more energy and time we spend looking at the European stuff, the more it emerges. Like Eastern Europe is so rich with this stuff. A lot of parts, actually. It's exciting to see her coming to life again in our consciousness in so many ways.
And it's I'm this is coming up, so I'm just gonna let's just go there. I want to hear your perspective on this. Like one of the things that I've been thinking about, and a concept that I've been toying with in my head for some time, is that of atonement, which I know is a really heavy word. It's got religious connotations, but atonement really means like at one with. And I've thought about if we and I'm coming to this from the context of animacy and saying, for example, well, if she's in the trees and she's the spiders and she's the frogs and all of that, do we even have to call it the divine feminine? And I find myself kind of getting hung up on saying, well, no, but yes, we do, because of this idea of atonement, because of the pain and the suffering and the deliberate separation. And also, I mean, it's not all deliberate, but there's very clear evidence of suppression of the sacred feminine in the European lineage for sure. And so I wonder how that lands for you. Like the idea of like, for me, it's almost like a skip over. Like you, like if you just try to go to animacy without acknowledging her, you're not doing the work, and she needs to be, we need to atone for what's happened.
I agree with you, and for me, I would say it's really comes down to a more pragmatic necessity, right? So, I mean, I totally get the feeling, like, hey, come on, wait a second. It's like, it's funny. I think about poetry. I think about free verse, because I remember when I first started realizing that I wanted to write my poems in meter, I remember feeling like there was this sort of like, hey, wait a minute, because women never really had a chance to make our mark in metrical poetry, because poetry had been in meter through all the centuries of patriarchy. And then right at the beginning of the 20th century, they threw meter out the window and all the poetry became free verse. And I was like, it really sucks. When I was starting in the 80s and 90s, like, women never had a chance to really make our mark in those great metrical meter, in those powerful meters. Instead, we're supposed to throw it all out. And it almost seemed like patriarchy did it on purpose just to not give us that powerful tool. So I totally understand the impulse to well, wait a minute, we never had a chance to really feel, why go directly to animacy when it's not fair, when we didn't have our chance to really appreciate the spirituality and the goddess as goddess, as something feminine. So there is that, but I don't even think it goes down to that because, yeah, of course, you can get over those things. You can do your work and get over your annoyance and move forward and say, okay, whatever. We just have to move forward, which is okay. But I think also there's another reason, even beyond just a sense of wanting to experience that for ourselves. I think there's another wanting to experience the divine feminine for ourselves as a spiritual reality. I think there's something more than that, which is pragmatically, I don't think people would get it, as I think you were implying. Like, if we go directly to animism, they're just going to assume that it's male somehow. Like, when my kids were little, every time we went to the zoo, they would tell us, oh, he, they would call the animals he all the time. And they're not. In fact, I learned during my Green Witch training with Susan Weed that, most of the animals we see out there in nature are actually female. Like, they really are. And yet, because of our inherited patriarchal mindset, we're going to assume they're all male. And if we think nature's animistic and powerful, then we're going to assume it's all male because that's what our culture would bring to it right now. So just from a practical point of view, in order to survive as a species, I think it's very helpful to have the idea of the divine feminine and the qualities we associate with feminine that, in spite of, liberal feminism and all its failings and also its achievements, the way liberal feminism has allowed women to get the power of men within our culture to a certain extent, I think everybody kind of gets it that women are really not part of the system. We're just not, that this system we're in was invented by men for men with men, all of it, mind, body, heart, will, spirit. I can go through the little cycle of it. You've got the war, you've got the rules and the laws, you've got the exchange economy, you've got the patriarchal family, you've got the monotheistic God. All of these are aspects of the patriarchal system, and women are not naturally, seems to me, I don't, I am an essentialist, I guess, speaking only for myself, maybe not for other women, but I'm an essentialist for myself. For me, identifying as a woman helps me understand the ways that this stuff just doesn't feel right for me, never has. And I think a lot of people have those feelings that women represent an alternative universe. And if we think of the divine feminine as the divine feminine, it'll make space for us to begin to, put the sun at the center of the universe instead of having the earth at the center of the universe. Like, we're at another Copernican revolution. We need to recenter. So we need to center something different than what we've had at the center before. And in order to put something different at the center, I think we need to hold space for it to be really different than what we have now. And I think the concept of the divine feminine allows us to hold space for something really, really different than what we have now and remind ourselves constantly that, yeah, it's different. And that's what we need, not only because it's, fair and fun, but it's also to survive as a species. We are not going to survive. And I've read wonderful quotes lately from some really smart women saying this. I think bell hooks said it really well. Heidi Guttner-Abendroth, who I mentioned earlier as the matriarchal studies scholar, she said it recently too. We're going to survive as a matriarchy or not at all. Like, the human species was a matriarchy for 35,000 years. We've only been a patriarchy for about 5,000 years. And during that 5,000 years, we've practically destroyed ourselves and the planet. And we are not going to survive as the human species unless we go back to the matriarchal ways. It's not going to happen. So it's very pragmatic, it seems to me, to have the concept of the divine feminine, of the goddess, as a way to constantly remind us, this is how it is. This is how it is now. It's different, a whole different way.
And I wonder if you could speak to, for any listeners who are not aware of, I think sometimes people hear matriarchy and they just assume it's the reverse of patriarchy where women are running everything. I wonder if you could just speak to that a little bit about what you mean by matriarchy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm using it pretty much the way Heidi Guttner-Abendroth uses it. There was a whole big controversy about whether to use the term matriarchy for exactly that reason. And people have proposed other things like metristic societies, or there's another one as well, to try to defamiliarize it. But Heidi maintains that she uses the word matriarchy because when you go back to the beginning of the word, it means in the beginning. Arche means beginning. It doesn't mean ruling or power. It means in the beginning. And she says, matriarchy was there in the beginning, and I'm okay with that. I've come around to it. The thing is, I guess the most important thing is that, well, looking at her characteristics of a matriarchal society, the four characteristics that she says define a matriarchal society are consensus decision making, a gift economy, matriarchal family structure, or matrilineal, sorry, consensus decision making, a gift economy, matrilineal family structure, where the daughters live with the mother and the daughters and whatever partner, because they don't have marriage in these cultures. But if a man is hooked up with a daughter, then he'll come and live in her mother's house at night. And then usually he'll go back and help his mother during the day. So they don't have marriage in any way, like with the daughter having to go to the husband's house, which is the beginning of all evil, in my opinion. So the matrilineal family structure, and finally, worship of the divine feminine. So consensus decision making, gift economy, matrilineal family structure, worship of the divine feminine, and what you end up with when you have all these things. And I would add a fifth that Heidi, I don't think, agrees with. I've checked with her, but I would add sexual self-determination and complete human freedom as the fifth element of matriarchal societies from what I've understood so far. But you have all of these elements together, you're not going to have what we think of as patriarchy in the slightest, right? Patriarchy, as we think of it, is the opposite of these things. Instead of consensus decision making, you have one person making decisions for others. Instead of the gift economy, you have the exchange economy, exploitation, destruction of the world. Instead of the matrilineal family system, you have the patriarchal family system, patrilineal, which is hell on wheels. I've spent a lot of time in India, and I know how destructive that is for women to have to leave their mother and go live in with their father, with their husband's mother-in-law and father-in-law. Oh my gosh. And then, instead of human freedom, the respect and the sexual and autonomy, you have control of people in that way as well. And then, of course, you have, instead of the divine feminine, the goddess with all her zillions of faces, you have monotheism, hell on wheels. So, it's different from patriarchy in every possible way, it seems to me, matriarchy. And I use the word now in the same way that Heidi does, meaning in the beginning. It's the earliest thing. It's the beginning thing. But yeah, it's the first reaction. And even here where I am at this retreat center and did this wonderful ceremony, and I was talking to some of these young men, and they heard the word matriarchy and they were like, oh, but then they got it immediately. They were like, oh, I get it. Matriarchies are not hierarchical. And I'm like, nope, not at all. And then they started remembering like the indigenous groups that they've hung out with here, and thinking of the difference in the way the ceremonies are handled. Like when if the women are handling the ceremony, they want to do things together. It's all easy. It's flowing. There's nobody particular in charge. The authority is shared. It's spontaneous. It's more informal, inclusive, and playful. And when the men were in charge, it's like there's very clear rules. Things are rigid. There's people take turns. There's a kind of more of a rivalry sense, but even between the father and the son, in this case they were describing.
So good, Annie. Oh my gosh, this resonates with me so much. I feel like we could keep talking about this for hours, but I do want to make sure, since we're running out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about your relationship with poetry, and specifically how poetry has been a language that has helped you. I don't know. I want you to say, but like access the goddess, connect to the goddess, be a mouthpiece for her. How I don't even know how you would describe that, but.
Well, it's funny because when I was growing up, to me, poetry was sacred. Like it just was. And I wasn't really aware of the goddess. My sense of spirituality, I mentioned that my dad was into world religions and there were thousands and thousands of books, but none about the divine feminine. But to me, I think the muse was the goddess. Like the muse and poetic inspiration was my channel to the divine feminine, partly because my mother was a poet and she was also a witch, even though she didn't know it yet. So when she, the way she taught me about poetry and the way she initiated me into poetry was a very goddessy kind of experience for me. It was really a way that I connected with her spiritually, was through our shared passion for poetry. So it really felt as if poetry was a spiritual path in itself. And I thought it was, like so many poets nowadays do. You know, they feel that poetry is sort of spiritual and that's it. They don't need, you know, art is spiritual. So many people, I think, feel that nowadays. And it wasn't until I then discovered, think there was a point where I suddenly began to realize, after I became aware of the goddess, when I moved to California and I began to be aware of witchcraft and goddess things, and I had that experience I told you about with Kuan Yin. Around that point, I began to realize that the muse was a goddess, and the muse really was a goddess. Like that, I had been into the muse of poetic inspiration all along, but actually, that was the goddess all along. And then I had this incredible experience of going to the Midwest and becoming like part of a earth spirituality group and having to write poetry for the seasons and Wiccan poetry. And that's when I began to put two and two together. And I was like, I am a religious poet. I'm a religious poet of the goddess. So that was a huge revelation for me. I had never thought of myself as a particular kind of poet. But since then, it's just gotten stronger and stronger. And so, like, my first book published in 1997 was my first book of poetry called Eve, was all about goddesses, and it was organized into nine sections. Each one was dedicated to a different goddess. And I found that all my poems I'd written so far, like, fit into those goddess categories. And then I did my book Spells, was very spiritual, very goddessy. And then the poetry, which little book of spells, which is like pocket rituals. And there's a whole section called She Who, which is all poems, little, this is a book of tiny little poems, like to fit in your pocket. The poetry, which little book of spells. So it has like little poems and spells to cast a circle, to mark the wheel of the year, and also to honor different goddesses. And then it's gotten more and more like that. And then my brand new book that I'm just finishing, Amulets for Brave Women, it's shamelessly goddess. It's like full of goddess stuff. So now I don't even, when I left the university, I got a lot more free to write about what I want to. And so now I just embrace it. It's become one. Like there's no separation anymore between poetry and the goddess for me. It's the same thing. And I think that's an original, going back to the origins of poetry, maybe. You know, I think poetry was probably originally the language of the goddess. And that's how I see it.
That makes so much sense to me because just in my own journey, I wrote poetry when I was younger, and then I put it aside because I'm like, well, I'm not trained in this. This is just sort of like moving through me, so therefore it must not be good. You know, these are the things we tell ourselves, right? Like, why would I, or I can't make money on it, so why would I waste my time on this? But one of the things that sort of came online for me around the time that the Divine Feminine showed up is this just burning need to write poetry again. And yeah, and you know, I've mostly just done it for myself. But so when you talk about the, you know, the muse, like that, you know, being the goddess, that really, really resonates with me. And yeah, and so I mean, since we have you here, I would really love it if you would be willing to share some of your poetry for listeners. It feels like a just a beautiful way to round out what we've talked about today.
Oh, that would be absolutely wonderful, because it's wonderful to find an audience that already understands the goddess, because so often when I share my poetry, I feel like I have to also initiate people or educate them into what it's actually about. But hello, all of you wonderful goddess aware people. Here are some of my offerings. So these are some tiny little poems from the Poetry Witch little book of spells. And actually, this what I did with this book was I took my big book Spells, which is like my selected poems that came out about 10 years ago, and I went through there and I just picked out the most powerful little moments from a whole bunch of different poems to create this tiny little pocket book that will just give you like the essence. So these are excerpts from bigger poems about the goddess. Okay, so I'm going to read these five little segments. They're each only about 3 lines long, and they're to different goddesses. And this one is for, I'll tell you who the goddesses are ahead of time, so I don't have to interrupt. Nut is the Egyptian goddess who arched over the whole sky. And they might have seen pictures like she's got her feet on one part of the earth and her hands are on the other, and her breasts are sort of hanging down over the earth. It's so beautiful. And then Brigid, the goddess of fire and poetry and healing from the Celtic world. And then Yemaya, the goddess of the ocean, who's in so many countries, loved all around Africa and the Caribbean. And Inanna, the Sumerian goddess who went down to the underworld. And then finally, Changing Woman, the Navajo goddess who never got old because when she started to get old, she would meet her younger self coming towards her. So these are the five of, there's actually nine altogether, but here's five of them. Nut. In the daylight, my hands reach out for home. In the night, the stars connect the stones and find their way. I'm going to do the whole one of Brigid. It's short. She's the goddess of poetry, so it seems appropriate for Brigid. Ring, 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 hammers fall. The gold will all be beaten over sudden flaming fire moving from you, the pyre. Sweeten your cauldron until the sun runs with one flame through the day, and the healing water will sing, linger on tongues, burn away. Yamaya. Star of the ocean, flow wide in us. Blessings grow round and abide in us. Anna. A goddess goes down, and I can see her. She needs to go, decides to go. A goddess goes down, and I can hear her. Changing woman. Who is changing as I bend down to what the sky has sent us? Is she changing? Or the same.
Oh, beautiful.
Thank you. I thought I would read a couple more that are full poems. I had thought about reading a poem about Eve. It's a sonnet about Eve, and that seemed appropriate. It's from a sequence where I chose the forms and the meters that would have been used for the goddess in that original culture. And the other one is kind of a poem about the goddess as sexual, sacred sexuality.
Yes, yes to both. Let's do it. I want to hear them.
Okay, I'll just do it above. So this one is in my book, Spells, Eve. And the one I will close with is in my brand new book, Amulets for Brave Women, which isn't published yet. So that will be the one that's just shamelessly sexual and goddessy, and where I just don't even care anymore if I look like a mainstream poet. I'm just going for it. Okay, this is Eve. When Mother Eve took the first apple down from the tree that grew where nature's heart had been, and came tumbling, circling, rosy into sin, which goddesses were lost and which were found? What spirals moved in pity and unwound across our mother's body? With a spin of planets lost for us and all our kin. What serpents curved their mouths into a frown, but left their bodies twined in us like threads that lead us home to her? Her presence warms, and if I follow closely through the maze, it is to where her remembered reaching spreads its branching gifts. It is to her reaching arms that I reach, as if for somewhere near to praise.
Beautiful.
And this one is called Come. Will you come till the truth of her joy strikes the night? Will you come till she feels you in dark and in light? Will you come till you feel her without and within, from end to beginning, then follow her spin to unfurl a new body with each sacred buzz, till you come to believe her in all that she does? Will you come as she calls you till there's no way to stop? Will you come till you tremble wide open and rock? Will you come till she feels you in dark and in light? Will you come till the truth of her joy strikes your night?
So good and sensual and delightful. Wow.
Thank you. That was really fun to read aloud. I think it's finally finished. And if you look at it on the page, I'll put it up on the YouTube. It starts out with like small capital H's for her, but small Y's for you. But in the last stanza, it's a capital Y for you. So it's like you become a goddess yourself.
Yes. As you come. It's pretty great.
As you are.
Come as you are. Oh, I love it so much. Wow. Annie, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What a blessing to know you and to have an opportunity to be in conversation with you and to bring this conversation to our listeners. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Liz. It was a delight. I'm so happy to talk with you. What a treat it's been. And to connect with all of your amazing listeners. What an honor. What a joy. Thank you.
Yes. And tell us, yes, Goddess Bless. And tell if, and I'll be sure to put this in the show notes, but if people would like to learn more about you and your writings and your all the amazing things you're doing, where should they look?
Yeah. Well, I've got anniefinch.com is my website. And I do have some places where I teach meter writing to women, poetry and meter. And I'm also starting this, you know, as I mentioned before, it's not just that I'm teaching writing anymore. It's like this whole life of living in these five directions. So I'm calling it Goddess Languages, Five Goddess Languages. And I'm arranging a retreat in India in the fall of 2025, I think it'll be. So you can sign up for that on my website and for my spells letter to stay in the loop. And I'm also on YouTube and other places. So yeah, I would love to, you know, be connected with anyone who cares about poetry and witchery and the goddess.
Amazing. Yes. And I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. And yes, thank you again. And thanks to all of you, as always, for listening. If you like the show, you can leave it a favorable review. You can subscribe to it. You can tell your friends about it. You can do all those things if you so desire. And until next time, I don't know, I want to say something kind of edgy, like come as you are and take really good care of yourselves. And I'll be with you again very soon. To Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.